You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. Happy Friday. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We've made it through another week, perhaps not without some bruising and whiplash, it seems, especially in the realm of foreign policy. We've got a great show lined up for everyone today. We're going to start out with some of the harder news this afternoon. We're going to talk about Donald Trump's approach to foreign policy, specifically Russia and Ukraine. We've got a great expert for you. At the bottom of this hour, we're going to be joined by an expert on sleep, given that we have to spring forward this weekend. Anybody ever wonder why they don't spring forward Friday at like 4 o'clock? You know, let's just lose an hour of work time as opposed to Sunday morning at 2 a.m. We'll talk about that. We've got, of course, our Ask Maggie segment. And then my colleague Terry Barr joins me at 3:30 for what's good, local, and overlooked in Wisconsin. But let's start on the global stage. I am so excited to see my friend and yours, Professor Yoshiko Herrera from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. She's a professor of political science, expert on Russian politics, nationalism, identity, and ethnic policies. Basically, this lady knows a whole lot about what we're about to talk about. Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show, Yoshiko. It's really a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be here.
It was quite, not just the week, which was pretty insane, but it has been quite a span of about 6 weeks. Before I start with some of the questions, I wanted to refresh everyone's recollection about some of the things that have transpired because it has been so very, very, very busy. We had about 2+ weeks ago, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth stating that Ukraine will basically never join NATO. He followed that up shortly thereafter by saying that Ukraine needs to give up any hope of reclaiming the territory lost since Russia's full-scale invasion some many years ago now. That was then subsequently followed by Vice President J.D. Vance appearing in Munich, basically chastising the Western alliance, Western democracies that have been longtime allies of the United States. That then was followed by what can only be described as one of the most disastrous meetings of heads of state in the Oval Office, perhaps in history. Then over the weekend, so this was just this past weekend, Donald Trump announced the ceasing of all military aid to Ukraine. There seemed to be some positive movement when he did his pseudo State of the Union address on Tuesday night, announcing that there had been some outreach from President Volodymyr Zelensky, that peace talks may be moving forward. Of course, then on Wednesday, he announced that he was stopping the sharing of intelligence with Ukraine, a major setback. Yesterday, I can't believe it's every day I have to, these things are happening so quickly. Yesterday announced that he was basically revoking the asylum status of some 24,000 Ukrainians. And between all of these points in time, Russia launched one of its largest missile and drone attacks since the onset of its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, injuring some 10 people, dealing some pretty significant blows. Seemingly in response to that, overnight and then this morning, Donald Trump chastising Russia on social media, announcing that he may impose tariffs. I'm going to take a breath, Professor Herrera, because it has been quite a ride. And within the last hour, Donald Trump stating that Putin will be, quote, more generous in peace talks than, quote, difficult Ukraine. Professor Herrera, let's just start. Have I forgotten anything significant? Because there's simply been so much happening. Okay.
Let me just commend you on that list, because that was a very good summary. Just one little thing I want to note is that the asylum, the issue of Ukrainians in the United States, it's 240,000 Ukrainians who have temporary protected status. Most of those people are here living with family because they evacuate. It's very hard, obviously, to get to the U.S. from Ukraine. And so most of them are living with family. So yeah, it's 240,000.
But
he hasn't done it yet. He said he was thinking about it.
Yes.
But then they haven't made a decision yet. So I hope that will be one of the things that turns out to be something that could have been really horrible, but didn't end up.
Doesn't actually end up happening.
Yeah.
I want to ask you this fundamental question that occurred to me as, again, this last wave of missile and drone attacks from Russia. Clearly, Russia, emboldened by the lack of consistent approach from the Trump administration, to put it mildly, if you want to put it in more stark terms, emboldened by Trump's bear hug of Vladimir Putin, frankly, espousing talking points. Are we at a tipping point? Might Russia attempt to make even more advances, claim more territory in Ukraine, sensing a point of vulnerability, especially if intelligence sharing has indeed ceased? And secondly, this speaks, I think, more broadly to my concern over what are Russia's incentives now if you're going into peace talks? Where are the leverage points?
Yeah.
How do we move forward?
So many people thought that Russia, really since December. So December and January, Russia had extremely high losses. Some days in December and January, there were close to 2,000 casualties a day. Now that's dead, missing, and wounded, taken prisoner. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot per day. And December and January were some of the worst months in terms of casualties for Russia. Now, what were they doing? They were trying to take as much territory as they could, anticipating some kind of peace process. So for sure, they thought this is our, I mean, the sanctions have a mixed record. They inflicted some damage, inflicted a lot of long-term damage. But a lot of analysts think Russia could, you know, keep going for another couple of years. But they are facing various problems, inflation, other kinds of things. And so even though everybody wants to predict Russia is about to fall apart quickly, it keeps going. But nevertheless, they understand that in the future, they're probably going to be weaker than they are now. So they're trying to capture as much territory as they can. Ukrainians, for their part, also suffered a lot of casualties, but mostly have held on and only allowed Russia to make some incremental gains over the last, really, more than a year. The front lines haven't changed that much. So there has been a lot, even though it looks like a stalemate, there's actually been a tremendous amount of fighting going on with Russia trying to take as much territory as it can. Now, my thought from the beginning about the peace plan, about the ceasefire, about ending the war in 24 days is, okay, on the one hand, the war could end right now in 5 minutes. Russia could just say, we're done. We're pulling out. It's not a highly complex situation like Syria or Gaza, or like, whose land is it? How are we going to deal with this? Who's going to be there? It's very, very clear. Russia just gets out of Ukraine and the war ends. So, I mean, in that sense, it's not conceptually difficult. But from the beginning of the war, Russia has never moderated its demands. It has never said they want anything less than their maximalist demands of total control over Ukraine, denial of Ukrainian sovereignty, denial of Ukrainian nationhood, no foreign troops in Ukraine, no Ukraine and NATO, et cetera. So that is the problem. It's the problem in my view is it's not that I want to take sides. It's just like the problem of how the war is going to end is that Russia does not want to end the war. That's my opinion. And what you're seeing with the pressure on Ukraine is it has emboldened Russia to do even more. This really terrible decision to stop sharing intelligence with Ukraine, terrible and heartbreaking, has led you know, what does that intelligent do? It allows Ukraine to shoot down ballistic missiles from Russia. That's one of the things. It allows them to find long-range targets. And what Russia has done with that is use the opportunity to bomb relentlessly Ukraine even more in the last couple of days than they had been doing before, which was still doing a lot. So that's where the lack of pressure on Russia doesn't lead to less fighting. It leads Russia to more action. However, the sanctions, and especially if we were to put in blocking sanctions against a number of Russian banks, et cetera, if we were to block Russian oil revenue, oil and gas revenue, that could really make a big difference.
It's quite a moment that we find ourselves in with some of the leaders of Western European, again, at least putative allies of the United States, looking at actually seizing frozen Russian assets in their banks. I mean, we're at this very precarious point in time. Even yet today, President Trump saying from the Oval Office that Putin did not want to start the war in Ukraine and he wants to end this war. Is there any basis in fact or history, Professor, to support that pretty wild allegation from the current American president?
There's nothing to support the statement that Putin didn't want to start a war, but he may want to end it. I mean, in as favorable of terms,
yes.
Yeah, there's a possibility he's feeling the cost, but there's also a possibility he doesn't. He hasn't said he wants to end it, other than apparently to President Trump.
I have a follow-up question that's a little bit more broad in concept. President Trump has been saying, and I think certain U.S. officials, both on the Democratic and Republican side, have been saying that Western Europe needs to do more, both in terms of payments to NATO, which have increased over the last 5 to 6 years, and that they really need to do more to ensure both their individual safety as countries, but also as a bulwark against the Soviet Union. Is there any sort of silver lining here? Is that working to any extent? We've got about a minute, and of course we can finish on the other side if we have to take a breath.
Yes, Europe, there is a sea change in understanding in Europe. I think the break in the U.S. relationship, the U.S.-NATO relationship cannot be overstated. It's a huge, huge change in U.S. International relations over the last 8 years.
Folks,
so Europe is, and Europe understands that. Europe understands it can no longer count on the United States.
Folks, we're going to pick it right back up where we left off. What comes next as the United States adopts an increasingly isolationist posture with all of these global conflicts occurring? More with Professor Yoshiko Herrera of the University of Wisconsin-Madison when we come back right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. I'ma keep running because the winner don't quit on themselves.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Yes, indeed. The earth moving under our feet, tectonic plate shifts in U.S. foreign policy, and frankly, the way that the West and democracies respond to dictators worldwide. Today in China, President Xi Jinping, as well as his foreign minister, giving an address saying China is now the stabilizing influence in global affairs. Quite a shocking statement indicating that U.S. has now become destabilizing. Let's pick up there, Professor Herrera. Folks, if you're just joining us, we've got Professor Yoshiko Herrera, expert in Russian politics, professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison, also won the 2021 award, Chancellor's Award for Distinguished Teaching. Want to get that bit in there as well. Professor, is the U.S. now a destabilizing force in global politics? And if so, are the former conceptions that have basically prevailed since the end of World War II about who our U.S. allies, who our adversaries are. Do those categories even apply anymore?
Yeah, it really pains me to say it, but I think a destabilizing force is probably an accurate statement about this administration. Because beyond Ukraine, think about the tariffs. Think about the relationship with Canada. I mean, who would have thought we would be claiming we're going to have Canada be the 51st state? Territorial claims on Greenland or Panama. Those are destabilizing because they're destabilizing of international norms that, first of all, protect territorial sovereignty and respect territorial sovereignty of other countries. So I think that those claims are, you know, some people think it's funny, but I don't think it's very funny, especially given that Putin has just shown that he is willing to engage in this costly war, taking territory. And so it's really not a laughing matter. And we have a situation with China and Taiwan where they have made territorial claims on Taiwan, obviously for decades. And that you know, it's really not a laughing matter. And the trade is connected to the war in the sense that, for example, one of the things that's keeping China in check is that there is trade interdependence between China and the United States. And if the U.S. were to kind of capriciously just decide like, okay, we're going to totally blow up trade relations with China and harm their economy, what is to stop them in that case from saying, okay, then we'll fully arm Russia or we'll take over Taiwan? I mean, if they think they have nothing to gain from a positive relationship, cooperative relationship with the United States, then what would constrain them? So I think it's a lot of these things are very connected.
Very interrelated. I wanted to ask that very question. You know, Donald Trump's sending a letter to the Ayatollah that leads Iran, talking about trying to enter into discussions about their putative nuclear arsenal, or if they actually have workable nuclear long-range missiles. This occurred to me also as I was trying to zoom out and look at this situation from a broad geopolitical standpoint. As if the United States is pulling back, if indeed we're seeing destabilization, if countries believe that they cannot, with some reliability, predict the United States' response to certain things, and it's frankly its position of standing up to dictators, incursions and aggression that violate sovereign boundaries and the like. If Europe feels like it has to provide for its own defenses, you see an increasingly aggressive China, maybe vis-a-vis an invasion of Taiwan, etc. Are we now looking at a time period where nations may be looking not just to increase their military might, but actually looking to build their own nuclear arsenals, undoing what was decades of work to try to denuclearize the planet? Very, very scary moment. What do you think, Professor?
Yes. So one thing on the nuclear question, yes, unfortunately, a lesson that some people are drawing from the Russian invasion of Ukraine is that if Ukraine had had nuclear weapons, or if Ukraine had been in NATO under NATO's nuclear umbrella, that Russia would not have attacked it. And therefore, if you want to protect yourself from being attacked by a great power or a larger state, then you should have nuclear weapons. That's different. Definitely discussion of nuclear weapons in Europe is evolving. It would have been almost, well, it was off the table even for Finland to be part of NATO. Totally off the table for Germany to consider allowing nuclear weapons on their territory. And France is now talking about extending its nuclear umbrella. I mean, some of those things are not immediately realistic, but those discussions are happening. But just the final thing I want to note is it's not just U.S. isolationism and pulling back. It's actually disrupting long-standing alliances between the United States and Europe and making it unclear if the U.S. would even honor our NATO commitments. That's what's I think, sent shockwaves everywhere.
Can you put this into more tangible terms for regular people here at home? Oftentimes, foreign policy, these questions of geopolitics, feel so far removed from people. What I am concerned about is that as we see increased global destabilization, the expenditures of if people want to view it through this lens, the amount of money that the United States, even as it pursues isolationism, that will have to be driven into our military industrial complex and potentially over time, if there are active, more active conflicts in the world, will skyrocket. How do you see that question of just U.S. expenditures and taxpayer dollars, as well as how do people at home understand the potential medium and long-term impacts in their day-to-day lives?
Well, I think, okay, still the prospect of an invasion of the United States is still remote, you know, because we do have these oceans, and assuming Canada and Mexico don't try to invade us, assuming we don't try to invade Canada, then the prospect of a war in the United States is remote. The prospect of war in Europe is not remote. It's virtually no experts believe that if Putin is successful in Ukraine, that he will not go further in attacking Europe. So I think, you know, do we want to have vacations in Europe? Do we want to have a lifestyle that we used to have where we had friendly relations with states and people could live in peace and prosperity? Or do we want to be everywhere around the world preparing for war? And I think that's something that people have to think about, even if it's not just right now in the U.S., an immediate threat.
Folks, that's Professor Yoshiko Herrera. We're going to have you back very soon to continue this discussion. We could spend quite a lot of time. My thanks to you. Up next, we've got Dr. Deepa Burman talking about what does it mean for your sleep schedule as we spring forward this weekend. Keep it locked, everybody. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Time keeps on slipping, and it'll slip a little bit faster this Sunday evening. Remember to set your clocks forward when you go to bed on Sunday evening, because we're going to lose an hour. We're going to spring forward. That officially happens at 2 a.m. on Sunday. I've got an expert here with all of us to try to figure out how to plan for this. Can we recover from the deprivation? Her name is Dr. Deepa Burman. She is a pediatrician sleep specialist, also treats adults, and her raison d'etre is to improve the wellness of all of her patients through good sleep health. She is an associate professor of pediatrics and co-director of the Pediatric Sleep Evaluation Center at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome to the show, Dr. Burman. It's such a pleasure to have you here. I wanted to start with our little folks, with our babies and our toddlers. When their sleep schedules are disturbed, it is so much more challenging for them than it is for us adults to catch up. If parents are listening to the show right now, what's your best advice for these moments where we're either springing forward or falling back and where sleep schedules of our little folks get disrupted?
Thank you so much for having me today. And yes, that's a really, really important question when it comes to our babies as well as toddlers. Whenever their sleep schedules are disrupted, even by a short time, they might have a hard time falling asleep. They might have a hard time with functioning well during the day. We can actually, in toddlers, we see more acting out behaviors, more tantrums from that lost sleep. And what we can do as parents and caregivers is to actually prepare beforehand. One thing about the time change is that the more you anticipate an issue to be happening and the more you prepare, it might help you, especially during that transition week. So few days, even a day or two before the time change actually happens, if you start putting your child to bed even 10, 15 minutes earlier, it might help them adjust to that time change better. Also, waking up them up at the desired time, at a similar time every single day, even though it might feel that they are more tired, they are more groggy, will help them set their cycle a little bit sooner, because that exposes them to bright light in the morning. And giving ourselves patience and cutting ourselves some slack, because that's a stressful time for all of us, including the children, including the parents. And sometimes I feel the children are still able to get those morning nap. However, the parents and caregivers might have a harder time adjusting because they have to take care of their children. Plus, not everyone has the luxury to take a nap.
I wish we all had nap times built in, Dr. Berman. I think it would help us immeasurably. For adults that have challenges sleeping as they approach the springing forward, if that's a challenge for folks, especially with, again, the time change, what is your advice for adults in this particular time where we're, again, moving our clocks forward?
So here I would like to mention there might be two scenarios. One, if you are able to prepare ahead, similar to the children, a few days before the time change, trying to move your bedtime up by 15 minutes and your wake time up by 15 minutes. So when you're hit with that hour, it just suddenly doesn't dawn upon you. That's number one. However, we all know that sometimes in practical life scenario, you might not be able to do that, or there might be other things going on in our lives so that we can't move our schedules by 15 minutes. Like today is Friday and our time change is just coming up tomorrow night. In that scenario, waking up, even though you might be really sleepy and tired, waking up at your desired wake-up time and exposing yourself to bright light in the morning will help you set your internal body clock much faster than if you were to let yourself slide by and oversleep on the initial days following the time change.
Folks, we're talking with Dr. Deepa Berman. She's an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh. She is a sleep expert, tries to promote overall wellness through sleep health. I wanted to talk again about a different group of our young people, our teenagers and those in high school. There is this continuing debate that we hear all the time about the start time for school days. And all of us looking back, I remember those times well, because I was constantly exhausted on top of all of my academic responsibilities. So many kids these days have all sorts of extracurriculars. They tend to want to stay up later to get those things done, something sometimes by necessity, sometimes because that's the way their biological clock is functioning, their sleep clock. What's your view, Dr. Berman, about what is the best start time for school days, especially for those teenage years when our teenagers always seem to be wanting to sleep later?
So here I want to say that no earlier than 8 o'clock in the morning for high school students is the recommended school start time. Several parts of our country have actually gone to that. Time change is especially important in that population. So in our pre-adolescent adolescents, because what happens is naturally their tendency is to go to bed later. There is a natural shift in our circadian clock or our body clocks in that age group where there is a tendency to go to bed later and wake up later. We all know that with the school schedules and the other demands, they might not be able to follow that schedule. Now, when you add an hour of lost time and this daylight saving time to already delayed schedules, that really has a huge impact on our adolescents. There are several studies that show that around the time change, there is an increase in the rates of depression. Even suicide risk in adolescent goes up. Mood changes, irritability. There are issues with learning, memory processing. There was one study that actually showed that the SAT scores became lower in the daylight saving time compared to the standard time.
So you've heard it here from Dr. Deepa Berman, a sleep expert by any measure, saying, listen, we should not be having our high schoolers start their school days before 8 a.m. I think something for all of us as parents to take a look at and to take some special care. Your teenager isn't lazy because they want to sleep in. It's their circadian clock as they reach into adolescence. I wanted to ask you about this concept of morning people and night owls. Is that a real thing? Are some of us just more inclined to feel more productive or more awake in the later parts of the day? And are some of us just bright and bushy-tailed morning people?
Yes, so that is a thing. So So here I want to talk about the circadian clock inside our body. Every single cell in our body is actually governed by an internal body clock. Now, all those little clocks are governed by a master clock or the circadian clock that determines when you want to go to bed, when you want to wake up in the morning. It also determines the hormone secretion, the hunger and satiety cycles. So naturally, genetically, some of us are those morning larks, and some of us are those night owls, and some of us are those regular doves, which, you know, are regular schedule people. So yes, that is a thing, and it is genetically determined. However, it is also controlled by the light dark cycle and the exposure to sunlight and darkness, and so exposure to sunlight in the morning and darkness at night.
A follow-up question on this topic. I love it. Morning larks, night owls, and regular doves. I'm going to have to work that one in. I love those metaphors. Dr. Berman, in the United States especially, there seems to be a strain of our culture that rewards and exalts people who say things like, I only get 4 hours of sleep every night and I work 18 hours. That the idea of depriving oneself of sleep somehow connotes greater productivity, or that it is a laudable objective. As a sleep expert, Dr. Berman, what do you say to all of this? Is this a positive strain in our culture? And I have probably a good guess as to what your answer might be, but I wanted to get your expert take.
So, you know, I think you're absolutely right, but I would beg to differ here. It's
Please.
Not just in our culture, but I think it is globally. Getting less sleep and working more hours is somehow equated to this bravery medal where, you know, people almost show off that I can only sleep for 4 hours and I feel functional. However, what we tend to oversee is the harmful effects, not in the short run, but sometimes in the long run. Are those people really healthy? What is the impact of this cut short sleep on their cardiovascular or their heart health? What is the impact on long-term memory, long-term cognition? And what is the impact on dementia from this all this long-term sleep? So that is something to consider. And whenever I'm talking to people, I am always telling them that getting less sleep is actually not something that we should be proud of. In fact, in this day and age, if you are getting enough sleep and still functioning during the day and doing your work well, you should be applauded. So I think to that front, I also like to say that human beings are the only species that deliberately deprive ourselves of sleep, sometimes for no particular reason, and we have to stop doing it.
So on this very idea of sleep deprivation and that humans do this voluntarily, this is a unique thing among species, do you see any interrelationship between what I'm just going to call, you know, our attachment to our devices and the declining average attention span? So this attention economy where we have all of these inputs coming at us all of the time, there's always something. And frankly, we've made attention a commodity itself. And the fact that it appears that people aren't sleeping as much and they're sleeping more poorly than ever before. Is there a relationship there, Dr. Berman?
There is definitely a relationship between screen time and artificial light exposure. So when we think about light exposure and, you know, light keeping us up later at night, many times we are only thinking about the lights that are coming from handheld devices. However, the artificial lights in our environment also have a role to play. So, you know, the strongest signal, I was talking earlier about the body clock that governs our sleep-wake schedules. The strongest signal for your body to feel awake and alert in the morning is the sunlight or light exposure. Now, in the evening, what our body naturally wants to do is decrease that light exposure, because when that light exposure decreases, increases the melatonin, which is a chemical in our body that helps us fall asleep. Now, whenever we are increasing light either in form of artificial lights or lights in our house, the ambient light, or light from electronic media, television, phones, iPads, tablets, that has a harmful effect on our sleep-wake schedule, and that can keep us up at night and certainly cutting into our sleep time, because, you know, we all have felt that urge to answer that one last message or one last email. And think about adolescents whose whole social networking is through social media, and so the browsing and you know, constantly checking their phones. So here, it is important to think about that. And in the evening, not only thinking about turning off those electronics, but also turning off or dimming down the lights in your house. Now, when we think about light exposure via the electronic media, having an electronic plan and a turn off time is really, really important for our children, adolescents, as well as our adults. So 30 to 45 minutes before the target bedtime, if we can turn off their electronics, that would be helpful for their sleep.
You heard it here from Dr. Deepa Burman. 30 to 45 minutes before everybody's got to go to sleep, we got to unplug. It'll help immeasurably. We'll talk more sleep hygiene. I want to know how to deal with jet lag and what to do the night before a really big day. We continue our discussion of sleep health with Dr. Deepa Burman of the University of Pittsburgh Medical School after these brief messages right here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Do you talk in your sleep? I don't think I do, but how would I really know? Folks, my name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to this Friday edition of the Maggie Dawn Show right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Very fortunate to have with us a sleep expert, Dr. Deepa Burman of the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. She has both children and adults as patients, helping to promote overall health and wellness through sleep health. Dr. Burman, wanted to ask you a question. We've been talking about what is generically referred to as sleep hygiene. What happens if you've got a real good friend who always complains about their sleep? How do you help someone who's struggling with their sleep habits, whether it's a partner, a dear friend, a parent, your children? What's your advice?
So the number one advice I have for people who are struggling with sleep issues, especially if those issues relate to trouble going to bed, trouble waking up in the middle of the night, or waking up too early, is to have a consistent schedule. When it comes to sleep, regularity is the key. Going to bed at a similar time, but more importantly, waking up at the same time every single day. If we are able to do this on most nights of the week and the month and the year, a lot of our sleep issues will start to fall into a better place. In addition to that, getting into a good circadian rhythm with increased exposure to bright light in the morning, decreased exposure to light in the evening, and cutting down on caffeine or nicotine. So those are some of the things that people who have sleep issues should start out with, taking a step back and seeing, are these a problem in their life? Many times people who have sleep issues, they actually focus on the bedtime a lot and then tend to sleep in. However, that can sometimes backfire, and we need to handle that wake up time, and wake up time should be the same every single day of the week, including the weekdays as well as weekends.
Some of our texters on the line, and certainly myself, I'm hearkening back to my Wall Street lawyer days. The longest I ever spent awake was about 50 hours leading up to a trial, and I felt like I was losing my mind as well as my grip on reality. It was totally surreal. Folks, sleep deprivation throughout the week and making it up on the weekend not the way to good overall health. I'm not saying it. That's our expert guest this half hour, Dr. Deepa Burman of the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. When you've got a really big day coming up, a huge work presentation, or let's say you're getting up and you got to get all the family and the kids on an airplane for a long day of traveling, or when your child has a big exam or a big athletic event, what's the best way to prepare for that kind of big day?
So the number one thing here that I want to say is avoid going into that situation with the sleep debt. Mm. We all know, and I have done it too, before a vacation, we want to pack in every bit of work and finish up that work. And so, and many times if we're traveling across time zones, we go already into that situation with the sleep debt. So preparing a bit beforehand and making sure that when our sleep is tanked up, or when our gas is full, you have more to spare when you have those moments of lost sleep hours, as opposed to you're already going in with sleep deprivation.
So do not, don't burn the midnight oil and then hope to get a really restful sleep. Maybe go in with a little sleep surplus for your big, big day. Boy, I remember those nights taking the exams in grad school. Very nerve-wracking, but I always knew that after a certain point, very diminishing marginal returns to additional study hours. I'm sure as a medical student, you remember those times as well, Dr. Burman. Last question. Yes, maybe not our last question. We talked very briefly about traveling. What's the best way to combat jet lag, and are there different tactics depending on which way you're going?
Yeah, so depending on which way you're going, the best way to combat it is that figuring out what time zone you might be going into. And again, similar to these time changes, if you can do it adjusting gradually, and if you cannot do it, going into your the time zone that you're going into and making sure that using that bright light in the morning to your benefit to keep you more awake during the day, and decreasing the light exposure in the evening to help you fall asleep at night. Now, with the help of, you know, your physician, your primary care physician or pediatrician, you can also talk about use of melatonin in this scenario. Sometimes a low dose melatonin, especially if you're traveling for longer periods of time, can help you set a rhythm into a new time zone if you're crossing several different time zones for work.
Note, everyone, she didn't say get into a fight with your seatmate about who controls the shade on your airplane window. No, no, no. That is not a good solution for your jet lag problems. We've got just about a little bit over a minute left, Dr. Burman. I want to ask you and end with this. If you had like the top three things, I know we've been talking about a lot of this stuff generally and in different scenarios, but the top three things that you could share with people about how to improve their sleep health, and maybe some words to the wise about the importance of sleep to our overall well-being throughout every stage of our life. And I also want to thank you, Dr. Deepa Burman of the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. It's been a real pleasure. So please tell everybody who's listening, how important is this and what are your top three tips for sleep health?
Thank you so much. Sleep actually impacts every single organ system around in our body, from our brains to our heart to our kidneys to our hormone system. Sleep deprivation can actually not only lead to increased risk of heart disease, but can also impact our metabolism, leading to obesity. It can impact concentration, memory, mood issues, learning in children, poor behaviors, attention issues in children. And so a few different things that I want to say that you can do to take care of your sleep. Number one, regular sleep schedule. Number two, making sure that we turn off those electronics 30 minutes before bedtime. And if we can, get some activity during the day, bright during the morning.
We just lost.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.